Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 23rd of August, these are our main stories. A dramatic rescue in Pakistan after children were left dangling above a ravine in a cable car. The BRICS Economic Group, Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa consider adding new members to their bloc. The charred bodies of 18 people have been found by firefighters in northeastern Greece. Also in this podcast...
I know of people that have broke down and simply cried out of frustration and grief.
How the out-of-control wildfires in Canada have left long-standing Indigenous communities with nowhere to live. A helicopter chopping through the air high above Pakistan's mountainous northern region, where a terrifying hanging-by-a-thread drama has been playing out. Cable cars, or chairlifts, are commonly used to carry passengers across valleys and ravines in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. But earlier on Monday, one of those lifts, transporting six children and two adults, became perilously stranded hundreds of metres above the ground when two wires snapped. After several anxious hours, all on board were finally rescued, either by military helicopter or by local people working by floodlight on the ground using zip wires. My colleague Julian Marshall spoke to the BBC's Sahar Baloch in Islamabad.
So the day began with the news that around eight people are stranded in a cable car in the middle of the air. And what happened was that local media started to report on it. And then it began to also uncover that there are children on board. Like there were six children and two adults. And since a lot of rescue operations started, the military got in, and because there were no other way of rescuing these children, so military was called in. And since then, everybody was glued to their screens and watching how there was this rescue operation going on. There was also a sling operation in which a man from the SSG force of the military was coming down from the helicopter, and he made four different attempts of taking these children out of this stranded cable car. But for some reason, he was not able to. And on the fourth attempt, he was able to rescue two children. And there was, of course, a lot of people who were around that area also. There were parents who were in the crowd as well, and they were cheering at that point of time. But they were also holding on to, this fear that, what if, it all goes wrong and everything. So because the army helicopter during the day was also at an angle where it was also providing a lot of air. And there was anyway a strong windy day, but the army helicopter was also sort of adding to it, which was hindering the rescue operation. So at one point, local rescue operation teams were also called in because it was getting dark. And that's when we saw how local rescue teams also got into it.
And how did those local rescue teams rescue the remaining six people in the cable car?
Well, what they did was they created a parallel zip line. And then they rescued people. And, this is something that is very familiar to a lot of people who live in the northern region of Pakistan. They know how to sort of survive, and they are very self-sufficient in all of this. And this is clearly not the first time that a cable car has been suspended in midair. So they were very much willing to help. And, this was an idea which was suggested by a local rescue team member. And everybody acted on it because it was already dark. And everybody knew that they have already spent 14 hours trying to sort of rescue children and all. And there was also one kid who had a heart condition as well. So they got onto it and made sure that the zip line works.
Try to explain to me, because I don't quite understand. You had one cable car that was dangling on one line because two wires had broken. And there was a parallel wire, was there, to where the cable car was?
Yes, it was parallel to it. Like right next to it, there was another one which was built by the locals as well. It was also a rope. which was used, but it was a stronger one. It was a stronger cable, basically, I should say, which was also built. And basically what they did was that locally they made sure that the children were on top of it as well. And there was a rescue guy who was bringing these children. And you know how they usually do that during like these very daredevil kind of stunts and all, where they make sure that the person who they are rescuing is on top of them or at least on their backs. And then they zip them right down to security.
So they were brought down to the ground, were they, by zip wire?
Yes. Yes, they were. They were, yeah. There was a zip wire and they were like using it to literally rescue the children. And there is a video also. It's all across social media now being shared because these rescue teams are being called heroes right now. And this is how they made it possible that these people were rescued.
And a general sense of relief, I would imagine, in Pakistan that this particular drama ended in the way that it did.
Yes, for sure. Because, you know, this is, I think, the fourth consecutive day that we have had really like terrible news regarding children. There were all kinds of news coming in and they were really, really heartbreaking and really sad also because they were all around sexual abuse and stuff like that. Where there is another case which is going to be heard tomorrow. So this came as a very pleasant surprise that a lot of people were rescued and everybody on board was rescued. So people are literally cheering for now.
Sahar Baloch in Pakistan speaking to Julian Marshall. Altaf Hussain is a teacher who was on the scene today, and he told Julian about the crowds who'd gathered to watch the rescue operation.
There were people from the whole area. Some came from far to watch the rescue operation. And later in the day, a big contingent from the media arrived to report. They also clarified some mistakes they made earlier in the day. I'm a school teacher and I went there from my school. Everyone was very concerned.
Do you yourself use these cable cars to travel from one place to another?
I did not ride this particular cable car, but I did ride other cable cars over the gorges in this region, some even higher. But as you know, the infrastructure over here is not very good. These chairlifts are not really safe for us. I don't think they were installed or maintained properly. The system is very poor.
So will you continue to use these cable cars, these chairlifts, because of what has happened today?
You know, the thing is, the local people are not very happy about the situation. They have always said that these cable cars were not installed properly. Now they're saying that they will not let them operate these cars in this area.
But presumably they have to use them if they want to go about their jobs, their lives.
These chairlifts are a necessity because in this area the roads are pretty bad. We are an underdeveloped area. Not only roads, but we also do not get other amenities. There is lack of electricity, little education or health facilities. Of course, people in this area are physically strong. They can walk far. But when it comes to cable cars, they have no choice and have to use them. But I think they will not be that keen to use them after today's incident.
Teacher and eyewitness to that drama, Altaf Hussain in Pakistan. The African Union has suspended Niger from all its activities because of the military coup last month. The organisation warned against any interference in the country from outside Africa, including by private military companies, after the head of the Wagner group of Russian mercenaries, Yevgeny Prigozhin, claimed to be on the continent. Here's our West Africa correspondent, Maini Jones.
The statement from the AU is dated the 14th of August, but it was only released after Mr. Prigozhin published a video claiming to be working in Africa. In the video, the Wagner chief, who appears to be in an arid landscape, is dressed in military fatigues and carrying a rifle. Two trucks and half a dozen armed men are behind him in the distance. The BBC hasn't been able to verify the location of the video.
Temperature plus 50.
We are working. The temperature is over 50 degrees, he claims. Everything we like. The Wagner Group conducts reconnaissance. It makes Russia even greater on all continents, and Africa even freer, he says, and rounds off with justice and happiness for the African people. Wagner has been accused of great human rights abuses in a number of African countries. Niger's Western allies fear the mercenary group could use the crisis there to strengthen its presence in the Sahel region, south of the Sahara. It's already active in neighbouring Mali and Burkina Faso, which are both under military rule. The West African Economic and Political Group, ECOWAS, says it will send armed forces into Niger to return it to democracy. But the juntas in Burkina Faso and Mali have vowed to support Niger's coup leaders against any foreign aggression, leading to fears of a regional war.
Maini Jones. 18 people dead, their charred bodies found not far from the Turkish border, victims of a wildfire in northeastern Greece. The authorities say those killed by the flames are likely to have been migrants. Our Europe Regional editor Danny Eberhardt has more details.
The grim discovery was confirmed by the Greek Fire Service. It's the worst tragedy so far from wildfires which have ravaged the area since Saturday. The authorities said that, as there'd been no reports of missing residents, they were investigating whether the victims had entered the country illegally. Migrants regularly cross from Turkey, often hiding out in rural or forested areas to avoid being caught. Greece's immigration minister has said the incident once again highlighted the dangers of irregular migration. The fires around Alexandroupolis have led to a number of settlements being evacuated. Patients from a hospital, including newborn babies and people in intensive care, also had to be moved out hastily overnight to a ferry in the port when a wall of flame engulfed a nearby hillside. One hospital worker described chaotic scenes.
I've never experienced this. I've been working for 27 years. It's like war conditions, really. Stretchers scattered everywhere, patients here, drips there. We had to arrange them by clinic. We had to get them on their meds, their serums, everything. It's like a bomb dropped.
A number of other wildfires are burning across Greece. One has sent a pall of smoke over the capital, Athens, and prompted the authorities in a northern suburb to order evacuations. One resident described damage to properties.
The fire has entered the urban area. Houses, shops are burning based on the information we have, and the bad thing is that the fire has surrounded us. The winds are now very strong, approaching 10 on the Beaufort scale. It's a very difficult firefighting task. God help us.
Fast-moving conflagrations are, in places, threatening to trap emergency workers. A number of EU countries have already sent assistance to Greece, including waterbombing planes and teams of firefighters.
Danny Eberhardt. Apart from Greece, this summer has already been marred by wildfires in Spain, Algeria and Hawaii. Canada is also in the midst of its own wildfire season. About 30,000 people in the western province of British Columbia have been moved from their homes, many of them from indigenous communities. Officials have said the blazes have shown some signs of easing, but thousands are still unable to return to their homes. Chief Robert Louis is the leader of the West Bank First Nation and himself an evacuee. He spoke to Peter Goffin about the threat to indigenous areas and the loss of traditional lands.
We have several reserves. Iron Number 10 Reserve, which is closest to the city of Kelowna. Part of the reserve is evacuated, and the other part is on alert. So all in all, we must have 1,000 to 2,000 people in that evacuation.
And where are people going when they leave their homes?
Well, we're doing our best to accommodate as many people as we can, but they're all over. I mean, some are with family, like myself, for example. Some have moved into RVs for a while. I was told some were sleeping in their cars. Some have gone into emergency shelters. We have been working with the emergency services to try and provide whatever accommodation we can at our gymnasium, that sort of thing. I was evacuated Friday. We're still in that evacuation mode, and most likely the nearest I can figure from the emergency service personnel, I expect that will be all of this week before anyone's allowed to maybe consider returning.
What does it feel like to leave your home and all of your belongings behind, knowing they might be at risk from these fires?
Well, that's a very high anxiety feeling, I think, for those, maybe the elderly. I think it's absolutely traumatic. I know of peoples that have broke down and simply cried out of frustration and grief. Others take it with a grain of salt, and it's better to have your life. Your personal belongings is secondary. I think that's how you have to look at it. As long as you have your life, your health, and your family, I think that's number one.
Are there challenges that are unique to an indigenous community when it comes to evacuating, as opposed to, say, a city?
That's an interesting question. I mean, for us, we have an indigenous perspective of things. Here, we've got over 11,000 hectares of land that's burnt right now, and that they're still tallying how much more beyond that. But there's huge wildlife, for example, deer, bear. One individual caught on video, for example, a young fawn that was struggling in the water from the fires without knowing where the doe was. That's a major concern from an indigenous perspective. Another major concern for us is that the mountains and is where we get our medicines and plants. And we know that we have certain sites that we harvest. And we know that there are sites now that are totally gone, totally burnt. We don't know what the devastation is, but we fear the worst. So that kind of sets us a bit of a part. And, of course, our peoples have been here for many thousands of years, the first peoples of these lands. And from what I can gather, at least in more recent times, the last few hundred times, this fire is unprecedented. Never to the extent that our people can orally or remember. So this is kind of eye-opening, and I guess it fits with climatic changes that's happening not only here, but around the world.
Chief Robert Louis speaking to Peter Goffin. Still to come in this podcast. The rapper in Tunisia using her words to push for social change. The five countries that make up the BRICS trading bloc, Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, represent almost half the world's population and a quarter of the global economy, and many more countries now want to join. The leaders, minus Vladimir Putin, are meeting in Johannesburg together with at least 50 other heads of state and government. In advance of the summit, the Chinese President Xi Jinping met the South African host Cyril Ramaphosa.
We both believe that China and South Africa are major developing countries and emerging markets enjoying great influence. We should be global partners that uphold justice. We need to strengthen strategic cooperation and implement true multilateralism and work to boost the representation and the say of countries in the global south.
Our correspondent Nomsa Maseko is covering the summit in Johannesburg.
Currently, there are more than 20 other countries who have formally applied to join the group. And those countries include Africa's biggest economy, Nigeria, also Egypt, Argentina, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. However, it does not seem possible that all of them will be accepted to be part of the group. We are told that if any are accepted, it's going to be about four or five of them. At the same time, we don't know when exactly that is going to be announced, whether that announcement is going to happen at this summit or that it will happen at a later stage, because it's not all the five countries representing BRICS that are for the expansion of the group, with Brazil saying that expanding the group is something that they are not for. However, both South Africa and China saying that they think that an expansion could be possible.
One notable absence, though, Vladimir Putin.
Indeed, it was highly anticipated that he would be here, but facing possible arrest because of alleged war crimes that he is facing, that's why he did not come. But he did address the summit here via pre-recorded message in which he said that the de-dollarization of BRICS member states was inevitable and irreversible. And he also spoke about strengthening trade relations within the BRICS member states as well, and also saying that it was an obligation for Russia to ensure that it does deal with reducing hunger and providing trade to poor countries, particularly African countries.
Nomsa Maseko. Donald Trump says he'll hand himself in to the authorities in the US state of Georgia on Thursday. The former US president denies charges of racketeering and election interference in the swing state. While Mr. Trump prepares for his booking appearance in the city of Atlanta, his fellow Republican presidential hopefuls will be in the state of Wisconsin for their first debate. Justin Webb heard more from our North America reporter, Anthony Zerka.
In this case, he is just being booked. He's not being arraigned. The arraigned part of it is where he appears before a judge. That's going to happen at the beginning of September. But this is just him getting processed at the Fulton County prison. He's going to show up. He's going to have his mugshot taken, apparently, this time, which is something slightly new. Fingerprinted, have his information taken down. He's going to have to post a $200,000 bail. That is money that he has to put up in order to be allowed not to stay in prison, but to go back on his own recognizance, and that money would be forfeited for some reason he decides not to show up for future judicial proceedings. And then he goes on his way.
And what's he said about it?
Well, he was posting on his social media account nothing particularly new. He did say that he was going to be doing this on Thursday. That was open to speculation. Some people thought maybe he would do it on Wednesday at the same time the Republicans were debating, as a way of kind of upstaging his adversaries for the Republican presidential nomination. He once again called it a political episode, a political charging, that it was all contrived in order to try to interfere with his attempt to regain the White House. Lashed out against Fannie Willis, the district attorney who is heading up the charges against him, said that it was corrupt. And that was the same sort of line Donald Trump has had in regards to all of the charges against him in these multiple indictments.
You mentioned the debate, Anthony, that a debate, of course, which he's not going to take part in.
Exactly. He decided to give a pass to the debate. And there is certainly a strategic argument for what he's doing. He has a massive lead in the polls right now. But what I think we're going to see now is a debate stage without him on it, where all of these Republican rivals are kind of vying for attention. And I think there's going to be more pressure on people like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Vivek Ramaswamy, who is a tech entrepreneur who's running for the Republican nomination. All of them are going to try to do something that generates headlines and generates media coverage beyond just Wednesday evening, because if there aren't as many eyeballs watching on Wednesday evening to have any impact from this debate, they are going to have to do something newsworthy, and that's going to make them try to be a little more aggressive, perhaps, on the stage towards each other, since Donald Trump's not going to be there.
Anthony Zerka. When members of Italian high society gathered in Turin to celebrate the engagement of the banker Massimo Segre and the entrepreneur Cristina Seimandi, things didn't quite go as planned. In a shocking speech, Mr. Segre accused his fiancée of infidelity and ended the relationship. She's now accused him of gender violence after clips of that speech went viral, and she is threatening legal action. David Lewis has been following the story.
It was supposed to be a night of unbridled joy, romantic celebration and true love. But in a speech to the assembled guests, the groom-to-be, well, he had other ideas.
In questo caso, questa sera, desidero regalare a Cristina...
Tonight, I'd like to give Cristina the freedom to love someone, a well-known lawyer, whom she clearly cares for more than me. My dear Cristina, I know how much you are in love, both mentally and sexually. How did you manage to keep it to yourself? And I know that before him, you had a relationship with a well-known industrialist.
With his fiancée watching on, the 64-year-old continued to deliver a devastating account of their relationship and her alleged cheating. He said he was heartbroken and was leaving her that night. Guests, including big bankers and businessmen, who cheered as he took to the microphone, listened in stunned silence. Mr. Segre finished with an apology.
I wish you all the happiness with your new partner and to continue shining in the world as you have done all these years. Sorry to all of you, and good night.
It's not clear who recorded the footage at the millionaire's mansion and if it was the same person who leaked the video. Since the speech went viral, the now ex-couple have been trading barbs in the Italian press. When he started talking, I thought it was a joke, Mr. Mandi told the Italian newspaper Il Corriere della Sera. Then I was petrified. It was an act of abhorrent violence, she added. An advisor to Ms. Mandi says she'll probably take legal action after facing a barrage of negative comments on social media. Mr. Segre's lawyers say he never authorised the filming or sharing of his engagement party address.
David Lewis. Over the last few months, the Saudi Pro League, also known as the SPL, has shaken the football world by signing a string of high-profile players from famous European teams on record salaries. Last week, the Brazilian star Neymar became the latest to sign up to the Saudi League in a deal worth almost $100 million. On Saturday, he was unveiled in front of thousands of fans. Saudi clubs have collectively spent over $650 million during the summer transfer window to attract foreign players such as Karim Benzema, N'Golo Kante, Sadio Mane, among a sleuth of big names. BBC's Middle East business correspondent Samir Hashmi travelled to Riyadh to find out more.
A rapturous welcome for Neymar at his new club, Al Hilal. Al Hilal is one of Asia's most successful clubs. But for many supporters, Neymar's arrival marks the beginning of a new era for the team.
Neymar is a megastar player, Brazilian leader, and he will bring a lot of fans for like Al Hilal.
We are so happy that stars like Cristiano and Neymar are playing here in Saudi. We hope that the Saudi League will become as good as the other leagues in Europe.
A couple of months ago, the top four Saudi football clubs, including Al Hilal, were bought over by the PIF, the government-controlled sovereign wealth fund. This has enabled Saudi clubs to offer eye-watering salaries to attract some of the top names in football, including Cristiano Ronaldo and Karim Benzema. During the summer, there has been an influx of foreign players. One of them is Portuguese footballer Ruben Neves, who swapped the English Premier League for the Saudi Pro League and joined Al Hilal.
If you see the difference between this league now and a lot of other leagues, it's not there are not differences. I think people at the beginning, when the team started to sign players, the people didn't believe in this project. But I think everyone now is excited to see this league. Everyone now wants to see this league.
Sports is one of the main pillars of the country's Vision 2030 economic diversification program, which aims to reduce Saudi Arabia's reliance on oil revenues by building new industries and attracting more foreign capital. Some European leagues have criticized the strategy adopted by the SPL, but Chief Operating Officer Carlo Nohra says that they are focusing on making the project financially viable.
So we have a commitment to support this for however long it takes to deliver on the objectives of the strategy. However, the responsibility that we have against that commitment is to also take that commercialization element of the strategy and start increasing that so that we can be responsible for our own financial growth in the future and not to be wholly dependent on the government.
I'm walking on Tahlia Street, which is located in the heart of Riyadh. Now, this place is really popular because it's flooded with a lot of cafes, shisha bars, restaurants. Why? Because Riyadh's home team, Al Nasser, the club that Cristiano Ronaldo plays for, is in action right now. Saudi Arabia is a football-crazy nation with 80% of the population either playing, attending or watching the sport on TV. The kingdom's target is to elevate SPL in the world's top 10 in terms of revenues by 2030. It's still early to judge whether these bold investments would pay off in the long run, but the strategy has demonstrated the Gulf nation's ambition of becoming a major international football hub.
BBC's Middle East business correspondent Samir Hashmi. Now to Tunisia and a young woman who is turning her sensitivity and her gift with words into art. Fatan Ben Khaled, aka FBK, is a rare thing, a female rapper in Tunisia, and she's using her voice to fight for the improvement of society and women's equality. As she told the BBC's African music programme, This Is Africa.
Will you, 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 will you
The truth is, with rap in Tunisia, the revolution had a very big role to play. Many artists now dare to find a way to make their voice heard. Because we know what it was like before the revolution. The revolution opened the doors, especially for rappers. Now they can express their opinions on the political situation, on the social situation. This was forbidden before. But now we have the opportunity to express ourselves. We have to try, as hard as we can, to make our voices heard, to try to change what's happening, even just a little bit. سيزاريان سبع شهور وجيت مزروبة أختي اختارت اسم وخويا فرح بالعجوبة سنين تجري وبراء عمال الذوب نشوف الدنيا نهار ومش عارفة اللي فما مغروب I wrote a song called Césarienne. I decided to do it because people wanted to know who FBK is, who Fetin is. They wanted to know more about my personality, my beginnings, my childhood. Today, Césarienne is still the song that helps people understand me and get to know me better. حتى الكلمة اللي كوتني كي صدقني زادت قوتني تقيدت في الكورال ناس غادية منتني ولسان معامي لطفي ومن غادي العبد عرفتني أثنية صعيبة الانسبيراشن منين انسبيري غنيت نتاعي Where do I get the inspiration to my songs? Okay, the truth is, I'm very free and open to different and varied sources. An artist must open their heads to the universe. I get inspired by nature, by my experiences, and by other people's experiences too when they touch me. Situations can happen to someone else and maybe it doesn't affect them. Maybe they don't feel it, but we know that artists are particularly sensitive and I'm sometimes excessively sensitive. I try to use that to write about things that touch me. دويا في مرضي الدعوة اليوم عرضين تشوقي ضحك على وجهك مرسومة حتى كغميقة تخلوقي تفهمها قصة الغزرة حتى كنخبيها قلوقي حتى دهري كيبلح وصدي وبما ترحمش قلت لي الدنيا راكي فيح قلت لي وصل ما تنغرش حتى انطلاقا من تجربتي الشخصية صحيح أنه الإنسان يتعرض لعراقيل In my experience, human beings encounter obstacles in their early stages. But what is noticeable is the huge control over women that men have in Arab societies in general and in Tunisian society in particular. There are big challenges for women who want to be rappers in Tunisia. Those women may encounter all sorts of exploitation. People say, oh, well, she's a woman. You know, there's a lot of belittling and disdain. It's normal because in our society, men have power over women. And women also get judged by their own family. For example, they would say, how come she sings rap? It's a boy thing. There's this cliche about rap, that it's an immoral art, that it's no good. A young female rapper can be accused of masculinity. But that has nothing to do with anything because art has never been linked or limited to a specific gender. Art is general, art is inclusive, art is universal. These views have to do with the ignorance of those who say them. As far as I'm concerned, I'm trying to move forward as much as possible. I'm trying to make progress in what I do and I'm trying to go beyond the Arab world, to go global. And God willing, I'll get there.
شكرا
الوقت اللي تعدى حسبته معاديني كان على الشده هاي كبرت في عيني قلبي ما ندى وظلامي مضويني ما نبكي على سكر ولا نعوم بكيني
فتن بن خالد And that's all from us for now. But there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Stephanie Prentice. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.